Holly and I weren't the type to keep quiet when there was a problem. Sarah, although the creator of the show and a producer, had zero power and didn't like to make waves. She worked for the boss's wife, a vital point that one must understand if one wants to keep one's job. My mother, sitting in my dressing room while we discussed our plan to meet with the CBS heads, wagged her finger anew. "Ma, stop," I said. "We're gonna get it all out in the open. It'll be good." She just shook her head no and said, "You are so stupid if you think this is a great plan." We had gone through 3 executive producers before the end of the first season, and to welcome our new EP, we decided to all meet at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Before the Go Team dinner, I had talked to Julie on the phone for an hour about the terrible prospect of Sharon leaving. I knew she was serious about it because she had pitched Holly and me for an NBC show Howie Mandel wanted to do. But CBS really felt like family, so I wanted to make the talk work. "Meet with her an hour before our dinner so that you can massage her a little," I said to Julie. "We really don't want her to quit." Heartened by the fact that Julie listened to my advice, I decided to send an email out to all the hosts the night before the dinner. I thought this was as good a time as any to kind of clear the air. "Looking forward to seeing everybody," I wrote. "It's going to be a new wave. It's going to be positive, so know that." And I was feeling positive when I walked into the Polo Lounge in the Beverly Hills Hotel the next night to find Sharon and Julie deep in conversation. I went to sit down, but Julie said, "Oh, we need more time." "Sure, of course," I said, because I was in on this idea with Julie. So I went to the bar, where I waited until the rest of the cast and our new executive producer showed up. Then we proceeded to the table, where we made small talk for about 5 minutes before Sharon answered one of my pleasantries with a serious attack. "Who do you think you are sending an email like that to everybody?" she asked, staring me down from across the table. "What do you mean?" "Oh, come on. You know, sending that positive email when you're the most negative person on the show." "I'm negative or I care? Because I love how everybody asks me in the morning meetings what they should say because they know I'll tell you if you're going to look like a complete asshole or not." "So yeah, I am harsh, but it's because I want this show to be good. So when I say to the producers, what are we doing that's a little bit more interesting than The View? It's not to be a bitch, but to be better. Meanwhile, you saunter in when you feel like it and give everyone a hard time. So if you think caring means a bad attitude, then yes, I have one. The only reason you care is because you're a loser and you have nothing else going on in your life." "Oh, did everyone hear that?" I said, looking around at the table where everyone else was dead quiet. "Honestly, Sharon, it would be in your best interest to just back it down." "Or what?" "Or what?" I said incredulously. "Or you're going to get your lowlife mafia family after me?" "No, I'm going to take this iced tea that I'm holding in my hand and I'm going to crack it over your fucking head." And with that, I got up from the table before anyone could see the tears in my eyes and I went outside to pull myself together. Holly quickly joined me, trying to console me. I was confused and hurt. Yes, I thought I'm a pain in the ass, but weren't we a team? Clearly, Holly was the only one who took my side and stuck up for me. That's why she and I have remained friends to this day. Despite all the ups and downs I went through on the talk, I really did think things were going to turn out okay. It might sound absurd for someone who almost got into a fist fight with their co-host to say that, but TV is a high-stakes business where passions run high. Having been on a sitcom for 9 years where there were periods when Kevin and I weren't talking to each other or the writers weren't talking to either of us, I thought we would get through this because to me a show is a family and all families fight, but they eventually get past their rough moments. I was so convinced that I had a future with the talk that I hosted a wrap party with Holly at her house after our first season when CBS didn't want to pay for one. We even bought wrap gifts, mugs that said, "I survived season one." Cut to the summer of 2011, not long after the wrap party, I got a call from my agent. "Your and Holly's options are not getting picked up for season 2. Well, this was the new version of "it's not going any further." I could only believe that Sharon was behind it, so apparently my mom was right again. You know, they say when you get older, you learn that your parents might actually know what they're talking about. At the time, it hurt a lot because Holly and I had helped launch this show. Our blood, sweat, and tears went into it, so To be discarded in the way that we were felt horrible. Not to mention that Holly and I had gone to bat for Sharon, who I blamed for what had happened to us. Of course, Sharon denied having anything to do with it. Our ex-co-host then added insult to injury by going on every program they could to talk about us and say that we were fired because we weren't authentic. Every time they needed a ratings bump, they discussed us on the Howard Stern show and said things about us like that we were ghetto or that they'd heard there's a catering job that opened up on the set. Maybe Leah can get that. I was shocked that they would pull such a childish and vindictive publicity stunt. Coming from the King of Queens, I wasn't used to all the power games and backstabbing. It was the depressing but real side of Hollywood, where everyone is so worried about their own job that they'll do anything to keep it. While we had plenty of opportunity to respond to the attacks, Holly and I took the high road and didn't comment in return. It would have just added fuel to the fire. Not blaming anyone else for the way I acted. My humor can come off as abrasive or degrading, so much so that I was actually called into human resources while I worked on the talk, where I got reprimanded for how I spoke to people. And I don't even blame myself. Certain environments don't bring out the best in you, and I can say with full confidence that although I don't have any regrets, the talk wasn't my finest moment. A few years later, as fate would have it, I took a recurring guest role on The X's, which filmed on a stage upstairs from The Talk. So while working on the TV Land sitcom, I could actually hear the host of The Talk show below me. I saw my old dressing room, all the guest rooms I personally shot for and decorated. I felt it was my baby too. I helped launch it. What I should have known was this. The show was going to be on air, regardless of my fighting for it to be better. One day, while I was sitting outside my ex's dressing room, who should walk by but Julie Chen? I was angry for a long, long time after leaving that show, but in that moment, there was something in my heart that said, let it go. My outlook in life as a Scientologist caused me to ask what responsibility I had for the place I found myself in. So with all those things and more running through my head, I made a quick decision. I stood up, grabbed Julie, and hugged her. I'm sorry for my part, I said. While hugging me, she was also trying to pull back and get away, but I said, it's not going to happen. I'm not disengaging, so this uncomfortable moment's going to go on a little bit longer, Julie, which made her laugh. I let her go, and she smiled broadly at me and said, I hope everybody's well and that you're well, and I wish you nothing but the best. Her reply was poised and polite. I felt like I had done my work, and I was ready to move on, regardless of whether she or the rest of the co-hosts had. Even now, after decades in this business, I still have moments where I'm trying to fit in as an actress in Hollywood, as if I were somehow an imposter. For so long, I looked for acceptance from everyone, from my dad to the people in this town. What I have slowly come to realize and often still have to remind myself of is this. There is no right way to be. I am flawed and imperfect, but am uniquely me. I don't fit in and probably never will, and I don't have to try to anymore. That other person was a lie. And let's face it, normal is boring. We all have something to offer the world in some way. But by not being our authentic selves, we are robbing the world of something different, something special. My time at The Talk was a lesson in learning who my true friends were. If there's one thing I can brag about and be proud of in my life, it's my dedication to friendship. If I call you a friend, I mean it. You are now on par with being a family member. Friendships are not made overnight. It takes time, effort, and energy. For me, friendships are not tested in the best of times, but in the worst of times. You don't always get a second chance to be there for someone when they really need you. So when I say I will be there, I mean it. And when I need you, you better be there. Everyone has deal breakers, and this is one of mine. If real friends are hard to come by in life, you can imagine what it's like in Hollywood. I have said I can count on one hand the number of real men I have met in this town. Finding real friends who will step up and say or do the right thing on your behalf is almost impossible as well. Most are just looking to save their asses or their jobs. Loudmouths who will say anything to anyone but secretly apologize behind closed doors. Leading actors, big executives, and powerful people talk a big game until they realize their jobs might be on the line and they instantly become complete and utter pussies. Stupidly, perhaps, and sometimes at the cost of my own job or being labeled difficult, I'm willing to say shit to people no matter who they are and what the consequences may be. And yes, in the end, I'm probably cutting off my nose to spite my face, but that's who I am. When I started to write this chapter, I had planned to spill all the details behind why Holly and I were not asked back to season two. But then, as I read it over, I thought I would just be doing what they wanted, and I would be no better than them. So yes, I was an asshole when it came to defending myself, the other host, and the show as a whole. Rather than kiss everyone's ass, I brazenly and oftentimes obnoxiously spoke my mind, and as a result, lost my job. But I stood by what I thought was right, and I was a friend to those who I felt deserved my friendship. While I'm able to forgive those who spoke out against me at the talk, I have learned a very valuable lesson in Hollywood and in life. By their actions, they will show you who they are. Chapter 16. In 2012, 6 years into their marriage, Tom Cruise announced that he and Katie Holmes were getting a divorce. Katie and her team of lawyers initiated the proceedings with her formal filing of divorce. Rumors started flying immediately, speculating that there would be an explosive showdown over custody for Siri and fears of revelations of secret facts about Tom's life. While Katie's team denied any of the rumors, the divorce was settled in less than 2 weeks and Katie ended up with primary custody. Tom seemed to acknowledge that Katie left because she wanted to protect Siri from Scientology. Made me wonder whether protecting his church was more important to him than his own daughter. Katie's action of filing for divorce in such a public way, it had quickly been picked up by the media, would definitely get her declared a suppressive person, an SP, by the church. It had always been my understanding that as a Scientologist, you have the right to request that any knowledge reports written by an SP be removed from your files. I had been fighting for years to get the Cruise wedding fallout expunged from my files, so as soon as I heard the news of the divorce, I picked up the phone and called my auditor, Todd, and said, "What do you have to say to me now?" "I guess you can expect to have that report taken out of your folder," he replied. We met shortly thereafter, and Todd basically admitted that they had screwed up about moving me off my OT levels and onto the training track after speaking up about everything I had seen in Italy. "Look," he said, "you got some bad auditing the last time you were at Flag. Putting you into training was not the right thing to do. In fact, it was all wrong. Go back to Flag and go back into auditing." This would, of course, be at my expense. Now that my church seemingly had realized that it had fucked up and was starting to apply LRH policies again, I wondered where were the apologies to me from everyone involved in the wedding debacle. After I reported on what I saw in Italy, I was made to feel like I was crazy and that I was the only one to witness these things. Yet Norman Starkey was sent home early from Italy in disgrace. And guess who got divorced and remarried? Less than a year after the wedding, Jessica and Tommy, who were all over each other at the wedding, both took extensive leaves from the Sea Org, and later wound up married to each other after divorcing their spouses. So, did I get a plaque that said, "You were right"? Nope. And I never got an answer about Shelley Miscavige's whereabouts. I made up for the damage that they had accused me of doing. What about the damage they did to me? Well, if it was all wrong, are you going to give me back my money? Because as a Scientologist, when I'm reprimanded, I'm asked, what am I going to do to make up the damage? So now I'm asking you, what are you going to do to make up the damage? "What do you mean?" Todd said. "Are you asking for a refund?" Although the church publicly claims that it will simply return funds to anyone who is dissatisfied, the reality of this policy is quite different. In fact, requesting a return of money from the Church of Scientology is classified as a Scientology high crime or suppressive act, which qualifies one to be declared a suppressive person. And, in an even more bizarre twist, Once the church declares you an SP, a suppressive person, according to its policy, you are no longer eligible for a return of your money. It is the perfect catch-22. If you ask for your money back, you will be declared a suppressive person and thereby no longer qualify to get your money back. No, I'm not asking for a refund, I responded. What I'm saying is, what does the church do to take responsibility for its actions? When I fucked up, I spent my hiatus from the King of Queens in Florida in session 12 hours a day having my ass handed to me, so I want to know what you people do when you fuck up. Eventually, after some time, Todd came back to me and said it's done, and that I would get the $300,000 credited to my account. I believed him, never bothering to check my accounts. Why would I? To me, Todd's word was that of my church. Todd went on to encourage me to get back onto my OT levels, but I decided that I wanted to continue pursuing the auditor training path because I like the idea of helping people, working with pre-clears, counseling them. With the church's seeming admission of having messed up the wedding fallout and its agreeing to return my money, I began to re-engage, dedicating myself in the weeks that followed to moving ahead in my training as an auditor. But one thing still nagged at me, the fact that no one would tell me where Shelley Miscavige was. When I would ask Todd during our sessions, he would take me outside where there were no recording devices and say, Shelley is a Sea Org member, and you're asking about the leader's wife. How do you expect people to react? I can't call COB and ask him. When I flat out asked if she was dead, he responded, I'm sure she's not dead, but you and I are not in a position to ask where the leader's wife is. I think it would be in your best interest to stop asking. In requesting my $300,000 back, I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that if this kind of problem with money happened to me, an outspoken celebrity in the church, similar things must be happening to so many others who suffered in silence. That just wasn't right. Having grown up a Scientologist, I knew firsthand the financial sacrifice that the church demands of its ordinary practitioners. I had met one man who said he was in foreclosure because of his sec check, and a mom who told me she had drained her daughter's college fund after she was sent to flag. On a more personal level, I had watched my whole family struggle to move up the bridge. They were $250,000 in debt at this point. The fact that people making average salaries of $50,000 a year somehow find a way to pay the $500,000 necessary to get onto their OT levels, frankly, it's a superhuman task. The level of dedication is astonishing and admirable, but over the long term, it means financial destruction for a lot of people and families. When anyone arrives at Flag, one of the first places he or she is sent to is the IAS, the International Association of Scientologists. It's one of the various wings in charge of getting donations out of parishioners. But the IAS is the 800-pound gorilla of extracting money from Scientologists for the church's monumentally important causes. Before you've even had time to go to your hotel room, they've looked up how much money you've donated to the church and immediately started to question it. Do you really think you're going to get onto OT7 with this donation? No matter what you say about the state of your finances, the fundraisers of the IAS can always find a way for you to give more. They'll ask you for your credit card number and its limit. Then they'll help you call Visa or Amex. They know exactly what to say to get your limit upped. And once they've helped you get that $10,000 or $25,000 credit limit increase, you end up charging that amount to your card as a donation. Either you're an able being or you're not. Able beings make major donations. And of course, any good Scientologist is expected to be able. I wondered how many Scientologists with far fewer resources than I had were in debt to the church because they had spoken out about something they saw that wasn't right and were punished with a costly security check or a course of reprogramming. I also continued to wonder why parishioners had to pay for the same things over and over again. While we had to keep purchasing new or revised textbook editions and CDs of the same policies courses we had already bought, forced to repeat courses if we wanted to move up the bridge, redo auditing actions over and over, all at our expense. If we were made to abide by the same rules of, you are responsible for all, why didn't the church say, hey, we fucked up on that process, so we're going to have you do it again at our expense? Instead, there was just no end to what was required of a parishioner. The response I would get whenever I voiced my concerns to someone in the church was, we just have to do it, or some other runaround excuse. No one was willing to challenge these financial practices, instead just accepting them as a status quo. Even more infuriating was my original complaint that, as parishioners, we had to make financial and spiritual amends for our wrongs, but the leaders of our faith took no responsibility for anything, ever. How could that be? Here was Tom Cruise being rewarded for being the most dedicated Scientologist on the planet. But you know who actually should get that reward? The guy who makes $75,000 a year and donates $250,000. Soon after my various conversations with Todd, I got a call from my handler, Shane, who worked with Todd on my service. You know what, Leah? I'm looking at things in your folder from over the years, and there have definitely been some issues in regards to your speaking up. Why don't I come over and I can help you write up some standard requests for withdrawal reports? Apparently the previous ones I had submitted to have earlier knowledge reports on me from people like Katie Holmes pulled from my file have been rejected due to the fact that I showed too much emotion in the language I used. I had found out that the requests were essentially ignored for years. I agreed to meet with Shane, and together we worked on the new requests. As we were working, I once again broached the subject of Shelley. I told Shane I found it surprising and concerning that I hadn't gotten a holiday card or thank you note from her after I sent her a gift that past Christmas. Something she had always been diligent about in the past. It wasn't like her. Shane, like Todd, responded with, I don't know. I can't ask where the leader's wife is. I figured as long as Shane was here trying to help me with the request for withdrawal, why not have him help me get a letter to Shelley? To which he agreed. I wrote the following note and gave it to him for delivery. Dear Shelley, it has been some time that I've seen or heard from you. I sent you a few Christmas cards and gifts. It was not like you to not write back right away. I had asked about you and was told you were on project. Out of respect, I didn't want to say, are they meaning you and Dave, not together, or is she on the RPF? I let it go for a bit, but it's been way too long now that I haven't seen or heard from you. I have come across some letters from you to me, my family, my daughter, and I just feel, as someone who I considered a friend, I needed to know that you were indeed okay. I get it that you might be busy and might very well be on project, but you were there for me when I needed you, and I don't take that lightly. Further, you were always in calm with us, meaning communication. I am sure you can understand why I would write. My cell is, with love, Leah. A week or so passed, and I called Shane to see if he'd been able to get the note to Shelley or if he'd gotten any response. He told me, honestly, Leah, I never sent the note. It was inappropriate the way you referred to COB's relationship. He told me to write a new note with a more appropriate tone and language. And so I did. Dear Shelley, it's been a while since we have spoken or seen each other. I came across a few letters that you had written to me and my daughter, and I thought, I really love and miss Shelley. What better way to show someone you love them than to not write them for 6 years? In parentheses, that's a joke. So I decided to write, smiley face. I think of you often, Shelley. You were really there for me when I needed you, and I will always consider you a friend. I would love to hear from you and have coffee with you. Call me. With love, Leah. Once again, I received no response. I later received word back that my letter was considered N-theta, meaning bad energy, sarcastic, angering, upsetting, and was basically thrown away. By this point, Shelley had been missing for more than 6 years. A few more weeks passed, and I'd yet to hear any responses from the MAA about the request for knowledge report withdrawals that Shane and I had submitted. I asked Shane about it, and he responded with, let me check on it. When a request for withdrawal of a knowledge report is reviewed and accepted, formal paperwork and documentation accompany the agreed-upon withdrawal so that the parishioner knows the request has been granted. When I asked Shane to provide me with the formal paperwork, he instead forwarded an unofficial email from NMAA stating that the request had been accepted. I knew this wasn't on policy. I was getting the runaround, and now I was starting to get pissed. I asked Shane for a full review of all my accounting with the church, as I had not received a $300,000 credit that I had been promised. Shane, in turn, accused me of asking for a refund. I once again told him, this is not a refund, this is a credit. A credit for all the shit you guys have screwed up. When will you accept accountability? And with that, I received a personal call from none other than the chairman of the board, COB, David Miscavige, asking if we can meet. I told him there was no point, but he insisted, offering to clear out the Celebrity Center for me, Tom Cruise style. I declined, but agreed to see him that night so I could confront the issue once and for all. Angelo, who was worried, said, "Babe, do you want me to go with you?" I refused. The last thing I wanted COB to think was that I needed backup. I was, after all, taller than David Miscavige. David Miscavige, the leader of Scientology, greeted me. His longtime assistant, Larice, whom I had seen with him at Tom and Katie's wedding, was also there. He immediately told me that he had been traveling and was not aware of what was going on with my situation. I repeated everything I had already said to others many, many times, plus I went on to ask, why wasn't anyone seeing Tom Cruise the way I saw him? Why, with his three failed marriages and couch-jumping antics, was he considered to be the epitome of a great Scientologist? Why was he not treated as an SP who should be in session 24 hours a day? And why couldn't I get an answer as to where David's wife, Shelley, was? He told me that Shelley was okay, and that he had to keep her away because SPs are constantly trying to have her subpoenaed. It was so out of left field that I don't even know how to respond. We talked a bit more, and all the while he continued saying he knew nothing about my problems, but that he would look into things for me. I agreed to have him investigate further and get back to me. I wasn't sure that I believed his offer to look into things, so, frustrated with the constant runaround I was getting, I started making phone calls. I broke another one of the cardinal rules of Scientology and began reaching out to those who had been deemed suppressive persons. I knew I was yet again stepping outside the bounds of what was acceptable to my church, but given my recent experiences, I couldn't help but wonder what had happened to these people, who had been very high up on the organization board, to make them give up everything and everyone in their lives. I reached out to Mike Rinder, who had left the church in 2007. I was honest with him that I wasn't a big fan of his because of the way he acted toward John Sweeney during the BBC documentary fiasco and a famous interview he gave to Dateline, in which he blatantly lied to all of America when he said there was no policy of disconnection in Scientology. But for the man who was head of OSA for 25 years, a Sea Org member for 40 years, and a Scientologist for 50 years to leave, something must have happened to him. I listened to what he and another former top executive had said, that Scientology's management, themselves included, was continually subjected to and inflicted physical beatings on other Sea Org members. I questioned him how this could possibly be. What about LRH policy? What you don't understand is that we were backed up by policy, Mike said to me. I was stunned. There were seemingly some secret flag orders and dispatches that Mike said he had seen that permit hitting and abusing people if it is in the course of getting someone to comply with policy, which would make it acceptable. According to several eyewitnesses' accounts, in the hole, a set of trailers at Gold Base, International Base, a remote 500-acre compound in Southern California, fallen executives are kept separated, humiliated, and often beaten. Mike said that, at the direction of and by the hand of David Miscavige, leaders of my church, including Mike, were subjected to punishments like being made to lick bathroom floors or being doused in cold water. Punishments that were so bad they felt they had no other choice but to flee. Mike decided enough was enough, choosing to leave the church and speak out. And, as a result, he lost contact with his son, his daughter, his wife of 30-plus years, his mother, brother, sister, and everyone else in his family. My assumption up to this point, that terrible things like what was happening in the hole were not an indictment of my church, but bad Scientologists misusing policy was wrong. Mike was saying that if David Miscavige was beating people, he wasn't misguided, he was following LRH policy, which is what all good Scientologists are taught to do. That's why, at the time, I thought it was okay, he told me. Of course, the Church of Scientology has always denied that any of this is true. The church says there is no hole, no abuse, no beatings, at least not by David Miscavige. But then why were so many former executives leaving Scientology and telling consistent stories of abuse? I also reached out to Debbie Cook, the woman who is the captain of the Flag Service Organization, FSO, which meant she ran Flag, which she did for 17 years. She had also been in the hole, but she wouldn't talk to me. The church was suing her for a violation of a contract after the famous New Year's Eve email that she wrote and disseminated on December 31st, 2012. In it, she described herself as dedicated to the technology of Dianetics and Scientology in the works of LRH. And I absolutely know it is worth fighting to keep it pure and unadulterated. But she went on to say, I do have some very serious concerns. Those concerns could be summed up in two words. David Miscavige. There never was supposed to be a leader other than LRH, she wrote. The church charged that the email violated the terms of the agreement she made back in 2007 after spending 7 weeks in the hole. But as Debbie testified in court, after the abuse she experienced in the hole, I would have signed that I stabbed babies over and over again and loved it. Scientology made the mistake of suing Debbie Cook, and in a Texas courtroom under oath, she described her experience in the hole, stating that she had watched David Miscavige punch people, and that for 12 hours she was made to stand in a trash can with a sign that read Lesbo hung around her neck. During this 12-hour period, cold water was periodically poured over her head while people screamed at her to admit she was gay. In Dianetics, LRH explicitly called homosexuality a perversion. Then later, he put being gay on the tone scale as covert hostility, which registers at 1.1 on the scale of human emotions, which is considered by Scientologists to be a person avoided at all costs. Reading Debbie's email started me on an internet search. In Scientology, you are told to stay away from the internet or other forms of media or intelligence that might be against Scientology. I broke away from this long-held rule and looked at hundreds of stories about my church and just sat there and cried. Not just for me, but for the many who believed in something they thought was bigger than themselves and dedicated their whole lives to sustaining it. How could I have been blind to the stories that the rest of the world knew? Scientologists are hardworking, dedicated, and caring people, albeit misinformed people, and I was no exception. The reason for their blind faith lies in their core belief that they alone have the answers to eradicate the ills of humanity. You run back to the safety of the group that shares your mentality, and in this way, your world becomes very insular. During my crisis of faith, I did what most people do in similar circumstances. I relied on my friends and family as a sounding board. But when I brought up my discoveries of abuse with John and Val Futris, my dear friends, former employer and closest confidants for the last 25 years, I was surprised by the reaction my concerns elicited. After confessing that I had read Debbie Cook's email and tried to contact her, I asked them why no Scientologist would read it. Why would I read N-Theta, Valerie said. How do you know it's N-Theta, I asked. Because it's from somebody who's against our group. It was somebody in our group, Valerie, and not just a somebody, but a trusted member. Debbie Cook was the captain of the FSO, on the front lines of Scientology for a very long time. Why wouldn't you give her the time of day to even look at what she has to say? Debbie and many of the others whose information and statements I was looking at were considered to be among the chiefs of our church. These weren't just some ex-parishioners, bitter apostates, kicked-out members looking for fame or a quick payout. These were men and women who were respected leaders in our church. who dedicated their lives not only to our church, but also to the Sea Org, signing billion-year contracts. They essentially gave up their lives for the church. Why would I go out of my way to read an enemy's email? It makes me wonder what you would do if I wrote an email like that. I wouldn't read it. That kills me inside. I mean, you wouldn't read an email from me? Are you kidding me, Val? You've known me since I was fucking 16. Once I opened myself up to the outside world, I heard so many terrible things. I learned what had happened to Sherry's brother, Stefan, years after he came to me for help in getting his wife, Tanya, back from Gold Base, where she was kept for 2 years. At one point, she was even put into isolation after she scaled an 8-foot wall topped by razor wire and jumped to freedom, only to be returned by Scientologists who found her walking along the highway. Stefan never gave up on getting Tanya back. Eventually, he came up with a plan that included sending her a Victoria's Secret box, which he knew the security guards wouldn't open because they wouldn't want to risk being caught going through lingerie, which would certainly be considered aberrated behavior. In the box, Tanya found a letter from Stefan and a cell phone so they could communicate. In 2006, 7 years after they were first separated, Stefan pulled up at Gold Base in a car, and in the middle of the night, Tanya jumped the wall again, and the pair drove off to freedom. Not long after I spoke to John and Val, Shane called me into the Celebrity Center, but when I arrived at my course room, I found him standing with two men I had never heard of or met before. Shane introduced me. This is Mike Sutter and Hanzuli Stali. They are executives from the church. They were sent here to talk to you. The two of them, I later found out, were infamously referred to as David Miscavige's henchmen. We wanted to sit down and answer any questions you might have, they said. Great. Where's Shelley? Rather than answer my question, they responded by showing me some policies they had on hand. I quickly dismissed them. They went on to say, we got a report that you're asking about Shelley and hooking up with the Debbie Cooks of the world. Well, let me see the reports, because as per LRH policies you just showed me, I should have gotten a copy of these reports. Well, it was a verbal report. A verbal report. Why don't you show me the LRH policy that says that's okay? You can't, because, you know, it's not policy. They stared at me. I turned my attention to Shane. Shane, did you not know that I asked about Shelley? Did you not know that I was questioning what was going on? Shane nodded that he did. You're all acting like I'm hiding something that I've been asking about for years. What the fuck kind of bullshit is this? Sutter and Stali started in on a presentation of the expansion of Scientology and all the buildings the church had recently purchased. Pointing to images of millions of dollars worth of Scientology's real estate holdings, Stali said, this is what we're doing, Leah. When you connect up with a Debbie Cook or a Mike Rinder, Sutter said to me, you're cutting across the survival of mankind and impeding what we're trying to do here. That's right. According to Sutter, just talking with an SP means you're trying to destroy Scientology by proxy. And if Scientology is humanity's only hope for salvation, well, I was on the wrong side. Listen, guys, I'll really appreciate the 8th grade presentation, but I could give a shit about buildings, I said. What I care about is myself, my family, and the people who are getting fucked by a church that doesn't give a shit about the truth, but rather buildings, which represent not only my millions of dollars, but the millions of people who don't have that kind of money, but continue to remain dedicated and contribute. As I went on and on, it was clear they had no idea what to do. They weren't prepared for this. I want answers as to why Tom Cruise seems to be running our church. I think he's an SP. I want answers on why we have to spend hours and hours in session for minor transgressions, but you people, the embodiment of ethics and morals, don't have to take responsibility for anything. I mean, what the fuck is going on here? I want answers about Shelley Miscavige. So do you have answers to where she is or anything else I'm asking about? No answers. They just acknowledge me, like every Scientologist learns in the introductory communication course. There were no human qualities to any of this. You're going to acknowledge me, and I'm going to want to throw you out that window, I said. I don't know who you think you're talking to, but you only acknowledging me is not the way you're going to handle me. So if you want to handle me, come straight and come with some fucking answers. Other than that, we're done. I then turned my attention to Shane. You honestly thought having these guys work on me would be a good idea? Well, it wasn't. And as I asked before, I want a full accounting of all my finances within the church. How much money have I spent in total on Scientology? I mean, honestly, I had no idea up until that point. How much has my family spent? I want all of it. And with that, I walked out the door and left. 2 days later, Shane and the commanding officer of the Celebrity Center, Dave Pettit, showed up at my house unannounced. Angelo answered the door, even though I said not to let them in, because I knew this was going to amount to more bullshit. Do you have answers as to where Shelley is? I said to Dave. Otherwise, I'm going to slam the door in your face. I do, he replied. So the four of us went into my office, where Dave and Shane began taking out all these LRH policies from Dave's briefcase. Oh, no, I'm not going to read policy, I said. You're refusing to read LRH policy, Shane said. Shane, I have read more policy than you. I'm higher than you on the bridge. I'm also higher trained. You're not going to school me on LRH, okay? So back to my original question, where's Shelley? I just need you to read this policy before we start, Dave said, sliding the paper across the table to me as if it was too much trouble for him to stand up and hand it to me. I slid it right back and stood up myself. Listen to me, Dave Pettit. You could take that policy and shove it up your ass. Where's Shelley? She's at Gold. Get her on the phone, I said. We don't have the number. You don't have the number, Shane? Really? You want to play games? I walked over to the phone near my computer. Okay, let's call Tom DeVocht. Maybe he has the number. Tom, a former Sea Org officer who dealt intimately with David Miscavige, would have the number to Gold. Leah, Shane said, what's happening to you? You're playing games with me, I said. Then turned to Angelo. You see what's going on here? Didn't they say they had answers about where Shelley was, and now he doesn't even know the number to Gold? Then I turned to Shane and said, if I don't get answers, an apology, and the money I'm owed, I'm going to call the cops and the FBI. I know you've known me to make empty threats in the past, but mark my words, Shane, this one will happen, so I better get some fucking answers. Leah, Shane continued. Angelo interrupted him. Actually, stop. Just give her the answer you said you had. Where is Shelley? Leah, David said, ignoring Angelo, what's happening? Why are you talking to Debbie Cook? Why don't you make Tom Cruise disconnect from Nicole Kidman and Katie Holmes, both of whom you declared to be SPs? Everybody else in the world has to suffer and cut ties, but when it's Tom Cruise, your God, policy doesn't apply to him. Families are being destroyed every day by this, but not Tom Cruise, never Tom. So you're bullshit and the church is bullshit. You're a fucking bitch, Shane said. Angelo jumped up out of his seat, slammed the door to the office shut so Shane couldn't escape, and cocked his fist. Listen, man, Shane stammered. You don't call my wife a fucking bitch in front of me in our house, Angelo seethed. Like a trapped animal, Shane didn't know what to do. Apologize to my wife, Angelo said. Angelo, please, he said. I didn't lift a finger to stop Angelo. I wanted him to bust Shane's ass no matter what the consequences were. I mean, I was full on ready to be arrested. You know, I'd put on a little lipstick, mugshot ready. I'd take the bullet to see this asshole go down. I was so hyped up, I wondered if I could take Dave Pettit. But my fantasy was interrupted when Shane said, sorry, Leah. Then he ran out of the house with Dave not far behind. Shortly thereafter, I was called in to meet with David Miscavige again. We talked about what I knew to be my bad auditing at Flag. He was trying to justify what had happened to me and claimed that it was Jessica, who was the one who had sent a written communication on his behalf to get me handled, that Jessica called the code red on me, not him. Dave, it's not just about me, it's about the whole thing. Families are being destroyed, people are in debt, OTs are leaving, highly trained auditors are leaving, something's not right. He asked me to give names. Dave, come on. How about at the next event, you ask to see a show of hands from all the people who are in debt because of this church? He laughed as if I was being ridiculous, but I wasn't kidding. My whole family is in financial ruin. I mean, it's happening every day. He questioned the fact that I had reached out to people like Debbie Cook and Mike Grinder, referring to them as his enemies. I don't know that they're your enemies. I know that they left the church, and I know that they're claiming to have been abused by other Sea Org members. He dismissed what I was saying and tried to move the conversation along and focus on the good. Sick of the many dismissals and runaround I was getting, I refused to focus on the good. Instead, I started talking to him about my concerns with Tom Cruise and what I perceived to be his overwhelming role in the church. Tom needs to shut his fucking mouth and stop representing Scientology, I said. Miscavige then directed the conversation toward getting me onto my OT levels. Not what I wanted to hear. I was surprised when I got a call shortly thereafter from Larise informing me that after nearly 6 long years, the $300,000 due to me was finally going to be credited to my account. I, in turn, asked for it to be provided to me in the form of a check, which she agreed to. I had Angela pick it up at the Celebrity Center, and it was deposited into my bank account. The church had finally done right by me, but my newly restored faith was quickly squashed when Susan Watson, the president of the Celebrity Center, called a week later and ordered me to come in right away with my mom and Angelo. The mother of the church, the woman who hugged me whenever I came in for auditing, who married Angelo and me, who loved my daughter, now treated me like I was a criminal. As I walked through those doors, it was like all of a sudden this place where I had spent most of my life, on course, helping others move up the bridge, fundraising, catching up with friends, was no longer my home, my refuge, my sanctuary. I was taken upstairs to my former auditing room, another space in which I had spent countless hours and gone through all kinds of emotions and experiences. But waiting there for me was not my auditor, but the MAA, Julian Schwartz, and Cassie Woodruff, Shane's wife. They were both glaring at me when I walked in. David Miscavige made the call, and now I, like those before me, who had questioned what was going on, was an enemy of the church. Looking at Cassie, I hostily said, "You don't speak now? What are you even doing here anyway?" "I'm here to chaperone," she said. And then I was shown the policy that states there must be a witness on hand when a parishioner is going to be severely reprimanded. Okay, I was ready for it. It was at this point that Julian started showing me more than a dozen reports that my so-called friends had written up about me. I later learned that as a result of my association with SPs like Debbie Cook and Mike Rinder and my speaking out against David Miscavige and Tom Cruise, Julian had reached out to all of my closest friends in the church and requested that they write knowledge reports on me regarding any disaffection toward the church that I might have expressed or anything negative I might have said about COB or any mentions I had made about reaching out to SPs and squirrel groups. Squirrel groups are those who collectively practice Scientology beliefs and techniques independently of the Church of Scientology. He showed me a few examples of the knowledge reports my friends had written, including those from John and Val Futris. Their reports pretty much just recapped what I had already said or expressed, including that after Tom and Katie's wedding, I thought I was unjustly sect-checked and investigated. That I was talking to John about Sea Org members being held against their will in the hole, and that I was continually asking people where Shelley was. Also that I had read Debbie Cook's New Year's Eve email. They went on to reveal that I felt that too many people doing their OT levels were completely broke and in debt, and that I disagreed with all of the money being spent on new buildings and design, as this was not what LRH would want, and instead suggested that it should be spent on getting people up the bridge and paying staff. Michelle Workman, a friend of 20 years, wrote about what I had revealed to her in my meetings with COB. That I thought the denials coming from COB about his knowledge of what was going on was bullshit, and that I might have said that Tom Cruise was an SP and running the church. "What's all this?" I fired back. "You tell me," Julian said. "What do you mean, me tell you? The fact that other people regurgitated my own story and wrote it in a report is meaningless. I reported it myself. Are you crazy?" They might have been crazy, but I was stupid. Despite everything that had happened over the past weeks, I still didn't think I was leaving Scientology. Even while making us think about subjects that most Scientologists wouldn't dare address, while confronting the church's leader, who was said to administer beatings, while personally declaring Tom Cruise, a pillar of the community, to be an SP, And while facing down Julian Schwartz and the many reports of condemnation, I still naively hoped that someone would step up and prove me wrong. I prayed that this belief system I had submitted to for most of my and my family's life wasn't, at best, a waste of time, at worst, evil. Make it right. Please make it right, I thought. Get Shelley, who has now been missing for more than 6 years, on the phone for me. Do something. I was actually naive enough to believe that all my carrying on, all my fuck yous and threats would lead to resolution. That David Miscavige would say, "You are right." That all my friends who wrote reports on me would apologize. Or at least that somebody would see the truth. But of course, that never happened. All Julian and the church focused on at this point was for me and my family to do a sec check, an interrogation by an ethics officer to make sure a person hasn't thought or acted in a hostile way toward the church. But I refused to bend. I wasn't going to submit to more scrutiny, more fines, and more punishment when I wasn't the one who did anything wrong. "I'm not going to do it," I told Julian. Instead, for 4 weeks, I went in every day, reading every policy Julian wanted me to read. He wanted to break me, to have me recant what I said, to admit that I was wrong to have done any investigating on my own. But I refused to acknowledge this. He also wanted to know which other celebrity parishioners were disaffected, a term Scientologists use to describe someone who is no longer willing to support certain church initiatives. Again, I refused to tell him. Finally, he asked me who I considered my friends to be. When I refused to include David Miscavige's name in the few names I had given, he tried to insist that I include it. I told him what he was asking was off policy, as this was not my realization, but rather something they were trying to force upon me. CLB is not my friend by the very actions he's taken against me. And why does he even care if I like him, I said, calling his bluff. You should be able to produce policy on this, and you can't, I went on, so I can only surmise that you're taking your orders from CLB, because I know you don't have the balls to talk to me that way unless you're being told to from above. And speaking of friends, during this time, many of my friends in the church started calling me, crying, "I'm not going to disconnect from you. I know your heart's in the right place." And then, after hearing from Julian, they would write me emails that read, "You have to get yourself handled." I was devastated when my friend Michelle Workman told me that after speaking with Julian, she believed that I was a liar. "By calling me a liar, what you're about to do is destroy a 35-year friendship," I responded. "Our children, who were born and raised together, will not know each other because you don't have the balls to stick up for what's right." After I revealed to another longtime Scientology friend what I had found out from my investigating, she replied that she was on my side, claiming, "You were on the right side of the tech. I know you're not an SP. You're saying that now, but your whole family is in the church," I said. "I understand if you need to disconnect." "There's no way I would ever do that," she said. A few days later, she called me, hysterically crying. "I was with Julian," she sobbed. "You don't have to say another word," I said, sensing what was coming next. "I love you and understand why you're calling me. If circumstances change, I'm here." We both said, "I love you," once more and hung up, knowing we would probably never speak again. These types of exchanges became too heartbreaking for me. In response, I blocked everybody in the church from writing, texting, or calling me. To be potentially branded a suppressive person, an SP, by a whole group I dedicated my life to and have all of its adherents turn their backs on me was incredibly sad. But not at all unique. It's something that happens to Scientologists every day. I wrote counter reports on all of them and told them not to contact me. Julian continued to press me about doing a sec check, and I continued to refuse. Then he ordered sec checks for my mother and George, which they agreed to. My mother didn't want to believe me about what was going on. that this was a witch hunt. I'm telling you, it's all leading up to me, I said to her. So if you want to submit yourself to a sex check, Mom, you're going to be really fucking sad when you realize that they just want intel on me. But go ahead and do it. She did just that. And in the process, Julian pulled the wool over her eyes to get her to doubt me. And he told her that David Miscavige offered to get me onto OT7 in L.A. instead of Flag in Florida, which is unheard of and also off LRH policy. I mean, everyone spends huge sums of money and up to 6 months to get onto OT7 at Flag, and Julian was claiming that I would get to magically do it in L.A.? He also told her that I basically told him to go to hell. Leah needs help. We need you to help her, Julian said to my mother. She's connected up with some pretty heavy SPs. She's making mistakes. She's making bad decisions. Anyone who has spent more than 5 minutes with my mother knows she can't keep a secret. Anything she is feeling shows immediately on her face. So as soon as Julian fed her that lie, she began acting weird. And anyone who knows me knows that I'm going to call you out the minute you're acting weird. Mom, you doing that thing. What's up? What thing? She said. My mom's resistance didn't last long. She finally let it out. I told her immediately that this invitation to do OT7 in L.A. wasn't true, but I knew I had to prove it to her or she would always have doubts. I wrote David Miscavige a letter right away, asking about his offer for me to do OT7 in L.A. and not in Florida. And I had the letter messengered to his office, where it was rejected. So I brought it to Julian directly and taunted him by saying, David Miscavige's offer was so gracious. I misunderstood you. I'd love to get onto OT7 here in L.A. Let's do it. Julian just glared at me. I showed my mom the letter I had written saying how I'd be thrilled to do OT7 in L.A. and how it was rejected by David Miscavige's office, and Julian didn't seem to have anything to say about the offer. And if that wasn't proof enough, after my mother did her last sex check, she said, you were right. It was bullshit. Just like with my stepfather's sex check. None of the questions were about her. They were all about me. What I knew, what they knew about me and Debbie Cook, what they knew about me and Mike Rinder. As I knew, it was all just to gain intel on me. On top of all of this, Julian had spread the word that my family and I were under investigation, which made us look horrible to everyone in the church. People averted their eyes when we walked by and refused to acknowledge us. And as a last effort to take us down, Julian threatened to take away all of my mom's certificates. Credits earned, thus she would have to throw away 30-plus years of training and start at the bottom of the bridge. And claimed that he had enough evidence of suppressive acts to get my stepfather, George, declared an SP. I, in turn, responded with, I'm not going to have a church tell me who I can and cannot talk to. That day is done. Where does it stop? What if my mother was an SP? Should I disconnect from my mother? Do you think I'd disconnect from anyone after the way you and the church have treated me? His response was, I'm not telling you to disconnect. LRH is. And with that, I decided I was done. I decided to sever ties with Scientology permanently. I could have just let it go. I could have simply walked away before being declared an SP. Then, if I ever wanted to come back to the church, they would have me. But I didn't want to leave that door open. I knew if I filed a police report about Shelley Miscavige, I would be declared an SP, and that would be the end. That was the step I had to take. So, I called the LAPD and asked, how do I officially file a missing persons report? Chapter 17. The Church of Scientology is known not only to pay big money to off-duty LAPD officers who work as security at the Celebrity Center and its other locations, it also employs a practice known as safe-pointing, meaning inviting members of various police and sheriff's departments that surround its churches to speak at events, presenting them with awards or donating money to their charities. So you never quite know who's in tight with the church. I met Detective Kevin Becker when he worked security on the set of The King of Queens, and we became fast friends. When I had brought Kevin to a Celebrity Center event as my date about a decade earlier, he was already familiar with the building security systems. His precinct was located nearby, and one time, when they were trying to find surveillance footage of the surrounding area for a recent crime that had been committed, they came to the church and asked to see their video feed. They have a better surveillance system than the police department does, Kevin remarked. When I decided I wanted to file a missing person report for Shelley, thus officially severing my ties with the church, I asked Kevin to help me. But I was concerned that it might put him in a bad position with the LAPD. If he took the report, he would be labeled an SP, and therefore might not be able to cover church events for the force or work there in an off-duty capacity. Fully aware of the risk he was taking, Kevin stood by me the whole way, no questions asked. He came to my house to take down the information for the missing person report, knowing that if I had gone into the police department, there might have been a person there who would alert the church. I explained to Kevin where I thought Shelley had been held for all these years, but of course, I couldn't confirm it. I also asked that if they did find Shelley in Hemet, California at Gold, where she was rumored to be, they try to pull her away from her handlers and give her a letter from me. Then I gave Kevin my letter. August 5th, 2013. Dear Shelley, it is not normal for you to be so out of communication. It's not normal for you not to be with your husband at the wedding. For years, I have been trying to get confirmation that you were okay. I was met with such resistance that it has caused me enough concern to go to extreme measures to make sure you were, in fact, okay. My letters were not sent to you, and I was told that I did not have the fucking rank to ask about Shelley. That is not human. Shelley, this is not right. I don't care what you think you are doing. This is not LRH. And you need to do something about it. You need to go with this gentleman now. I will take care of you. I will give you a home and the protection you need. From there, you can do what you need to do, but you need to leave right now. Don't worry about clothes, money, lawyers, and what this will do. This will all get worked out later. All you need to say to this person who has come to get you is, I want to leave with you now.